You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everyone, and welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. Hope your Wednesday afternoon is going well. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Got a great guest coming up in just a few moments. We're going to be talking about the bail system here in Wisconsin, but more broadly, that conversation on a national scale. What you should actually know about bail, what works and what doesn't, what is unique about Wisconsin laws, and what we should all be asking ourselves about Donald Trump's recent proposal relating to bail. Before we get to that, we've got some breaking news. This is being reported just this hour by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. A family in rural Wisconsin has retained a civil rights attorney and is calling for a hate crime investigation after a video captured a violent scene. A black teenager was being beaten by a group of young men at a party in the town of Pulaski in western Wisconsin. Iowa County Sheriff Michael Peterson called the video disturbing and said, "We have no place in society for violence like that." But he said an investigation by his office determined, based on witness account, that the attack on the teenager was not racially motivated. Civil rights attorney B. Ivory Lamar is representing the family and has called for that full investigation and for arrest to be made forthwith. We'll keep our eye on this story. Again, that is reporting this hour from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Credit to Journal Sentinel reporter Drake Bentley. With that, it is my pleasure to be joined this next half hour by retired Lieutenant Diane Goldstein. She is the executive director of the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, here to help us get smarter about all things bail. Welcome to the show, Lieutenant Goldstein. It is really a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much, Maggie. Really super honored. And this is such a critically important conversation. And every state is a little bit different. So I know you want to educate your listeners. So let's start with Wisconsin, and then I can lead into a couple different areas across the country that I think people would be kind of surprised on how cashless bail actually isn't effective in promoting public safety.
Thanks so much for that. Most folks here in Wisconsin didn't really, I think, even consider what our laws surrounding bail were here in the state until just a few years ago, the Waukesha County parade tragedy occurred. For those of you who remember this in vague terms, what had happened was a man who had been arrested on charges unrelated to that parade tragedy was granted a relatively low bail. At the time, the district attorney that was attending that bail hearing did not have the research that is typically provided to district attorneys that would indicate dangerousness and or prior criminal charges. As a result, relatively low bail set. That bail was then paid by that man. He went out and the Waukesha County parade tragedy occurred and lives were lost. It is an incredible tragedy. But in the wake of that tragedy here in Wisconsin, there were calls from everything from the then current Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm to be removed from his office, to all sorts of legislative proposals around cashless bail. What got lost in that discussion, Lieutenant Goldstein, was the fact that in the state of Wisconsin, the dangerousness of the accused defendant cannot be considered, I'll say that again, cannot be considered under state law in setting bail. The only factor that can be considered in setting bail is the likelihood of that person to return to face their further criminal proceedings. That has been a problem in the state of Wisconsin. There should be bail reform in the state of Wisconsin, in my opinion, to exclusively, not exclusively, but perhaps both the propensity to return for the rest of their criminal proceedings, but more importantly, the dangerousness and the safety threats posed to the community if that person is released. So with that as background, why this is an issue that is of top line political importance here in the state of Wisconsin, Lieutenant, please help us understand why this is such an issue nationally and why Donald Trump was issuing these directives and indicating his support for cashless bail.
Well, what, you know, is President Trump was actually trying to end cashless bail, which is really super interesting, given that he actually received cashless bail for all his myriad of criminal charges, right? And so what he's trying to do with cashless bail is he's trying to drive a political wedge that and use it to prevent federal dollars going to states where there is cashless bail. So I want your Wisconsin listeners to know that this isn't the only state that does this. New York has a bail law that's very similar that goes back decades. And I think this is the unintended consequence of legislators when they make laws that they don't look at what are the potential outcomes on this. I believe in cashless bail. Most importantly, the first factor that we need to determine is the risk to the public. And then as a equal measure is obviously failure to appear. And what people also need to understand is the bail industry has been opposing cashless bails because similar to the policing for profit issue around civil asset forfeiture, right, is cops want to keep civil asset forfeiture because it's a policing for profit. I would suggest to you that bail is the same. I've been working on this issue across multiple states in the past, and I want your listeners to understand that I was working sex crimes years ago. I had a long history, close to 22 years in law enforcement, and I did everything from gang work. I ran a surveillance team. I worked sex crimes. So I understand how important that risk assessment is. And I also understand how bail can absolutely ruin blue collar, hardworking families because they lose their jobs. They lose their access to, you know, their housing. There's so many different issues that are tied around this. So for folks that may remember, this is the Max Factor grandson years ago. I think this was like back in the early 2000s, ended up raping three women. And there was a really high bail that was put on him, but because he comes from tremendous amount of wealth, is he ended up absconding on his bail, ended up hiding in Mexico, the country, in Mexico. And then he was tried without his presence, convicted, and then Mexico returned him. And so if the appropriate assessment, whether you're rich or poor, is if you hurt someone, if you harm someone, if you are a risk to others, that should be the primary determination first, and then we can look at potential failure to appear.
Thanks so much. And again, folks, if you're just joining us, we're talking to retired Lieutenant Diane Goldstein, the executive director of the Law Enforcement Action Partnership. She's the first female lieutenant, by the way, at the Redondo Beach Police Department in California, served a distinguished career that covered many different units within the Redondo PD. What we are talking about when we speak about cashless bail and the support of a cashless bail system is this baseline concept that it should not be your family's wealth, your wealth, or the wealth that you may have access to because of your criminal activity that decides whether or not you are released before you are convicted. So you have been charged, right? There has been a probable cause, an indictment. You are facing criminal charges. There is going to be a criminal trial. And the question is, do you remain free before your trial? And cashless bail says, the principle, the idea, those that support cashless bail, as the lieutenant does and as I do, we say this: it should not be your wealth that determines your status as a free or incarcerated person in this country. It should be the risk or the threat that you pose to public safety, whether you are rich or poor. And that's what this is about. People that try to tell you it is about something else are misconstruing the issue. And thank you so much for bringing up the bail bonds industry, Lieutenant. There have been proposals, there have been discussions in the state of Wisconsin about introducing bail bonds here. We have not had that here. That is simply profiteering off of our criminal justice system. It is an abomination. It does not help improve public safety. And frankly, I am always appalled when it gets raised as, hey, maybe we should do this in Wisconsin. No, we shouldn't. And we need to reform our law here in Wisconsin, one, to adopt cashless bail, and two, to include dangerousness as the primary determinant factor of whether or not someone's released pending criminal trial. Given your experience in law enforcement, Lieutenant, please speak to the folks out there that, and I've got one of my usual conservative callers on the line, I'm sure with his hair on fire here. Speak to those folks who think that we should be releasing people based on their ability to pay bail. Why is that such a bad idea from a community safety perspective?
Sure. So you guys are Illinois adjacent, right? And I've done work in Illinois on cashless bail. And so, you know, Illinois is really interesting. They had the Pretrial Fairness Act in 2021. Once it passed, there was a lawsuit that got introduced pushing back against it. In fact, you know, saying this is going to cause all this danger. And then when the lawsuit flipped it over and said, no, there's no constitutional issues here. This law is perfectly good to be implemented. It rolled out in 2023. A recent study out of Loyola and the University of Chicago with the Brennan Center showed, and they did a comparison, and I think this is how we assess public safety. This is how we should be assessing policies based on outcomes. They did a comparison of the first 6 months of 2023 when the law was implemented and 2024, not just in looking at Chicago, but the state of Illinois. And they literally reflected no increase in crime. And in fact, what was really interesting when they started looking at the issue of failure to appear, because I think that's really important, before the law was implemented, prior to change, that FTA, the failure to appear rate was 17%. And literally a year later, it was down to 15%.
Wow.
Because there's all sorts of things that also happen around the issue of cashless bail. It's not just cashless bail. There are systems that you can put in place. And one of the things that we know across the country that you can use technology, especially yes. given the cell phones, that there's a lot of counties, there's a lot of states that are moving, or municipalities, court systems that are moving to, when they do this cashless bail, they also understand that people can be forgetful, right?
Yep. I'm gonna jump in. What you're talking about is electronic monitoring through a variety of different technologies. That's how you help ensure people return. And we're going to stop calling it cashless bail. I think we should start talking about it in terms of threat-based bail decisions, because it is a much greater capitalization of this issue. We're going to take care of a little business. We're going to come back with the lieutenant. We're going to talk more about this, as well as civil asset forfeitures and why every American and Wisconsinite should be concerned. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Stay with us.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. And a happy Wednesday afternoon to each and every one of you. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. A bit of an update. There is a two-car accident on John Nolan Drive in Madison. It's a doozy. Traffic has stopped in the outgoing lanes. This is the corner of John Nolan and Lakeside. We are getting reports of officers, fire department, and an ambulance on scene. Thanks so much to our listener, Jason in Madison, for texting in that update. Remember, you can always let us know about breaking news from your community. While I am on the air, 855-752-4842. That's 855-752-4842. Civic. Thanks again to Jason in Madison. I'm joined this half hour by Lieutenant Diane Goldstein, the Executive Director of the Law Enforcement Action Partnership. We're going to put the website for that organization that you can find at lawenforcementactionpartnership.org in our show notes for today. Remember, you can find our show notes and podcasts of these live broadcasts anywhere you get your favorite podcasts at, but always at civicmedia.us, also on Spotify and Apple Pods. Welcome back, Lieutenant. Before the break, we were talking a bit about the idea of civil asset forfeiture. Before we move on to that, I want to be sure that we have talked about and expressed what we need to discuss when it comes to the idea of what we are no longer going to call cashless bail, but what we will call, thanks to my friend Jacob, threat-based bail decisions or public safety-based bail decisions. Anything that we left out in this discussion that you think listeners should know?
No, I think, you know, I love that a listener called in because, quite frankly, I'm going to steal that line because that is exactly what we should be having this very, very frank discussion. You know, bail reform, the criminal justice system in its entirety is very nuanced and very layered. And what people don't understand is that the harms of criminal justice interventions, and we should hold people accountable. I'm not suggesting we don't, but what we see is if you are blue collar, living in poverty, you know, from a community that may not be as resourced as others, is that you are more likely to be kept in jail because you can't afford bail, you lose your job, then you get evicted, you can't make your car payments, you know, so there's
the cascading impacts, yes.
The cascading vicious circle over this issue. And I think all of us need to take a step back and say, does that make us any safer, or does that put people who are already at risk that may, you know, now have to shoplift in order to buy diapers for their baby, right? So there's the complexities of criminal justice. You can't just criminalize people. There has to be a functioning system where we are not siloed off from each other, but there's investments in other infrastructure that is just as efficacious in preventing crime than just throwing cops out to solve socioeconomic issues.
Well, and I let's take a pause here because fundamentally, getting into what works for violence response, right, and policing and punishment, that is an element of our criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. Violence prevention should also be a part of our discussion about public health, safety, and wellness, as well as criminal justice. I don't hear anything about that from a certain category of folks, and I think that that's to our collective detriment. But more fundamentally, when we're talking about threat-based bail determinations as the gold standard, what we are saying as Americans and as folks that live in a democracy is that we understand that rich people are treated much differently by our criminal justice system than poor folks are, and that is bad. That is the core of what we're trying to say, that the long arm of justice should not vary based upon bank account. And that when we see that happening, that actually undermines community safety. It undermines the trust in our court system and justice system. And that overall has this degrading impact on our communities and on public safety writ large. It is that larger discussion about how we want our system to work, how we want people to be treated equally under the law, that is really behind this argument. And I am so appreciative of you being with us here to talk about this, Lieutenant Goldstein. Again, you can find out more about her organization, the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, by going to their website. That's lawenforcementactionpartnership.org. Lieutenant Goldstein, we've got about a minute left, and I'm going to ask my senior producer, Jamie, to schedule you right away to come back and talk about civil asset forfeitures.
Perfect.
At greater length. But in a nutshell, what are they, and criminal asset forfeitures in particular, and why should people be concerned about them?
Sure. I think, again, if you appreciate the constitutional protections that all of us should have, right? It's not just Americans. You know, I think people forget that the Constitution protects anyone who is in our country. And civil asset forfeiture reform is simply the government being able to take your money without a criminal conviction. And that, just like so many of the other policies that are going on, upends our Constitution. And if we value democracy, we should value due process.
Due process has become a concept that I think all of us used to take for granted, and that seems to be eroded more and more with each passing day. I'm going to talk about just that thing and what the most conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals had to say about that this week in relation to the Alien Enemies Act. The Fifth Circuit, if you don't know who they are, they're stocked back to front with Trump-appointed judges. That comes up next right here. Welcome back, everybody. And welcome if you're rejoining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Big, big thanks to Lieutenant Diane Goldstein, a retired lieutenant from the Redondo Police Department, helping us understand what Donald Trump is actually proposing to eliminate when he's talking about bail. What he's proposing to eliminate is bail determinations that are based mostly on the threat to community if an accused defendant is released pending trial. That's what Donald Trump opposed. He's opposing threat-based bail determinations. And again, credit to my partner in this little endeavor, Jacob, who runs the boards every day. Thank you so much, Jacob, for pointing out that if we call things, if we label them the right way, in a way that actually helps people understand what's at issue, it may help eliminate some of the knee-jerk responses or opposition to it. So thank you, Jacob, for that. Folks, I wanted to take a few minutes in this last half hour. We don't have guests, so I'm going to open up the phone lines. We're going to try to get some calls and texts in here, 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. I wanted to take a moment and talk about a decision that dropped very late last night. This was the case that was challenging Donald Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. The Alien Enemies Act is a detention and deportation power that grants to the federal government the ability to, again, pick someone up and throw them out of the country because their country of origin is basically at war with the United States. And in March, President Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act in order to detain and deport specifically Venezuelans who are allegedly members of the gang Tren de Agua. Back in May, a federal judge in Texas ruled that the invocation was unlawful. That then went up through the appeals process. And the Supreme Court eventually enjoined that court's ruling and remanded it back down to the Fifth Circuit for further analysis of this issue. Now, the fact that the decision yesterday was from the Fifth Circuit is incredibly important. Why? Because most legal scholars would tell you that the Fifth Circuit right now is likely the most conservative, MAGA-friendly federal appeals court in the country. It is loaded with Trump-appointed judges from his first administration. The Fifth Circuit has ruled again and again and again and again and again and again and again in favor of the Trump administration. But yesterday, the Fifth Circuit did not. And again, the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 is a wartime authority. And the last time I checked, we're not at war with Venezuela. And so the gravamen of this particular case was really about two things. One, can the Alien Enemies Act be invoked to expel members of a gang based on Donald Trump's assertion that the gang is being directed by the Venezuelan government? A factual allegation that those who brought the lawsuit disputed. And in fact, the government of Venezuela, in a filing before the United Nations, actually said they have nothing to do with the Tren de Agua gang. They don't like it. They would prefer that the Tren de Agua gang went away. The second element of that case was about whether or not, the second element was assuming that the Alien Enemies Act can be invoked by the president. What due process, if any, is required before deporting people under the Alien Enemies Act? So again, it is this super conservative Fifth Circuit, and the judge that wrote last night's opinion, Judge Leslie Southwick, is a deeply respected, deeply conservative judge. And so the court's analysis in this case is so very important. And the arguments made by the Trump administration in this case are truly shocking. Because what the administration has argued in this case is that the court system, you know, that supposedly co-equal branch of government, the third branch, cannot review, has no authority to review any president's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act. Say what? I missed that part in civics class. I don't know about you and my 3 years in law school and the 20 plus years I've been practicing law, where, yeah, presidents get to do things and it's completely and utterly, entirely unreviewable by any court ever. So, this is where we found ourselves last night when the Fifth Circuit's opinion dropped. The Alien Enemies Act, again, adopted in 1798, authorizes the removal of, quote, natives, citizens, denizens, or subjects of the hostile nation if there is a, quote, declared war with a foreign nation or government, or a nation or government is engaged in an, quote, invasion or predatory incursion. The government admitted in this case that there is no war with Venezuela. So the question in this matter became, do we have an invasion or a predatory incursion? And the first thing that the Fifth Circuit had to decide was, indeed, the courts can review whether or not the facts as alleged by the Trump administration amount to a what? An invasion or a predatory incursion. And the Fifth Circuit said, yes, indeed. And here's the important part here. This is on page 11 of the decision. The court said this: we accept all presidential fact findings about what events have occurred, including who is directing them. So the Fifth Circuit is saying, we're not going to even debate with the Trump administration. We're not going to investigate. We're not going to have a hearing. We're not going to have discovery. We are going to take as gospel truth the Trump administration's assertion that the Venezuelan government is directing Tren de Agua, despite filings in international courts and before international bodies by Venezuela disputing that fact, despite all facts on the ground to the contrary. Even though that may very well be a bogus pretext, much like the pretext that a different federal judge today found was the basis for Donald Trump's attacks on Harvard and other elite universities. The Fifth Circuit says we're not going to go there. But they said this, quote, we conclude that proclaiming without more that an invasion or predatory incursion has occurred will not suffice. So the president gets to make up whatever the facts are. But those facts must actually rise to the level of an invasion or predatory incursion. And the Fifth Circuit concluded this. Courts are required to interpret the Alien Enemies Act after the president has invoked it. And this interpretation cannot be just an academic exercise. Thus, interpretation of the Alien Enemies Act allows a court to determine whether a declaration of war by Congress remains in effect or whether an invasion or predatory incursion has occurred. In other words, those questions are indeed reviewable by a court, and the executive's determination that certain facts constitute one or more of those events, an incursion or invasion is not conclusive. They go back to James Madison, and they quote from James Madison, "An invasion is an operation of war. To protect against invasion is an exercise of the power of war. A power, therefore, not incident to war, cannot be incident to a particular modification of war." And they go on. They go through this very technical analysis, this historical analysis, some case law analysis of whether or not there is an invasion by Trindade directed by Venezuela. And they define invasion in their decision yesterday as, quote, "an act of war involving the entry into this country by a military force of or at least directed by another country or nation with hostile intent." Well, Trindade, it might be a gang of thugs that we all think should be eliminated from the planet or locked up for all of eternity, but they ain't an armed force being directed by a government. They are not a military force. So, it ain't an invasion. The court then looks to whether or not we have a predatory incursion. I'm not sure what the differences between invasion and predatory incursion are, but they go through them. They come up with some distinctions. And by the way, while they go through the historical analysis of predatory incursion, they invoke a bunch of court analyses that deal with Native Americans and First Nation peoples, which is a little cringy. I mean, just hot tip for our federal courts, maybe don't invoke periods where the American federal government arguably engaged in genocide to help with your legal interpretations, but that's my aside. The Fifth Circuit, the most conservative circuit, in an opinion written by one of the most MAGA-friendly conservative judges to serve currently in the federal judiciary, concluded this: these predatory incursions all involved a military force of some meaningful size, organized in a manner related to the kind of enemy involved, whether an Indian tribe, this is the court's language, a distant foreign government, or an adjacent country using its own troops. The court concludes, we are convinced that a predatory incursion described armed forces of some size and cohesion engaged in something less than an invasion, whose objectives could vary widely and are directed by a foreign government or nation. We accept the finding that drug trafficking is being used as a weapon, but we hold it is not within even an updated meaning of invasion or predatory incursion. The completely accurate implication of this finding is that drugs are a scourge and weaken our citizens and our country, but it is not beyond reason that in 1798, an enemy country could try to sicken and physically weaken those within the United States. That would not have been an invasion or predatory incursion then, and it is not one today. To which the kids would say, damn! Okay, so all of that, again, we'll post the ruling in our show notes for today. What that means is the most conservative federal appeals court in the land, written by one of the most conservative MAGA-friendly judges in the land, has concluded that Donald Trump made a bunch of bogus stuff up and unconstitutionally invoked the Alien Enemies Act. Full stop. Pretty big doings. When we come back, we'll move on to lighter matters with this week's edition of Over the Hump and Trump. I'm going to try to squeeze a couple of calls in on the other side. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. You got a comment or question? Get it in quick. 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. You're not going to need to go anywhere if you're listening on WRCE, WISS, RJN, CQM, or WBZH, as they are all part of our Brewers affiliate broadcast network here on the Civic Media Radio Network. They'll be carrying the Brewers versus the Phillies game, 6:05 broadcast start. Again, just keep it rolling right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Wanted to give a couple of our callers a chance to respond. CJ's been super patient. CJ, go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you, Maggie. You know, I would have liked to ask, I was on hold for quite a while, I would have liked to ask your guest how she felt about Mandela Barnes' belief in defund the police. Because I think
it wasn't what the segment was about, of course. It was about
bail, and
threat-based bail determinations.
I wish you'd ask those tough questions, because I'm sure she would not agree with candidate Mandela Barnes. Thank God,
no.
Ron Johnson.
Well, and CJ, I don't either. I don't have time to get into a lengthy discourse on the defund the police movement. But suffice it to say that anybody who says that we should eliminate police forces or defund them is not having a serious conversation about keeping our community safe, in my opinion. They may be using the phrase defund the police to stand for something that is much more complicated, which our guest did address. And that is not just how we round up people who commit crimes in our community and punish them, which is an element of our democracy and civil society, but how we actually engage in meaningful violence prevention. And that requires a discussion that was more broader than what we had this afternoon. CJ, I appreciate you bringing up the point. We'll have that conversation again sometime soon. We didn't have time for it today, but I appreciate you raising the point. Charles, go ahead, sir.
Hey, Maggie, I thank you for breaking that down last segment, because I thought that Trump had the military blow up the boat in the water to try to draw some attention away from the Epstein victims today. But it makes sense. The court said that they're not attacking us. So we'll say we're blowing up a boat because they're bringing a bunch of drugs here to kill Americans.
Charles, you could do my job, sir. I didn't have enough time to explain the decision and then link it up to that. But I have been talking with some lawyers who have been studying this decision since it dropped yesterday. And the fact that our armed forces dropped or blew up a boat off the coast of Venezuela yesterday, many people have raised the potential that is Donald Trump doing that to effectively either incite or call it a war with Venezuela. That is precisely what the concern is, Charles. And I thank you for being such an attuned and careful listener to this program. Were there any other points you wanted to make, sir?
If I can make a real quick one.
Please.
I know you weren't talking about defund the police, but if CJ and other conservatives would take would get out of their bubble and actually do some fact checking, they would see that when it comes to not providing money for law enforcement, that is always Republicans, but somehow they've been able to frame it that Democrats want to defund the police. All they have to do is a little bit of reading, open up a book, go online, and they will see that when it comes to cutting funds for police departments, Republicans are always the one to do it, and then they try to put it on the backs of Democrats that Democrats want to defund the police.
And thanks for that, Charles. I think some of this cuts both ways, and I don't mean to both sides this question, and I will entertain a much longer discussion with people much smarter than I am about what do those words mean, defund the police, and what are the records of Democrats and Republicans when it comes to funding public safety. And when I say public safety, I mean that term comprehensively. I mean not just law enforcement funding. I mean not just the number of cops. And by the way, I've had on Republicans that have talked about a bill pending right now in our state legislature to help rural police departments fully staff their police departments, right? I have voiced my personal support of that measure. What we're talking about is not just the apprehension and punishment of those that commit crimes. We're talking about violence prevention. That is the full panoply of public safety. And when we leave part of that discussion behind, as conservatives are often inclined to do, or when we fully endorse Democrats who present an incomplete picture where they're challenging some of the opaqueness of law enforcement budgeting, how those taxpayer dollars are spent, or they outright oppose any funding of law enforcement, like Representative Ryan Clancy in our state legislature, that also is not a helpful dialogue, because there is no candidate that will ever win a statewide election in the state of Wisconsin if their policy platform is defund the police. That is not a salient policy perspective, and it helps distort in a negative way the very real conversation that we all should be willing to have as liberals, as progressives, as conservatives, as MAGA supporters, as centrists, as apolitical people, about how do we actually create better community safety. And those should be informed discussions. We should be looking at the data, and we should have some fidelity to facts. The complicated records of both Republicans and Democrats when it comes to the things that produce the best results, the most safety. Because I'll guarantee you, here is a thing that Charles and myself and CJ and everybody agrees on. Every single American, every single Wisconsinite deserves to live in their communities and have that community be safe. We should be concerned about results, not rhetoric. That's where I'm going to have to leave it today. I'm sorry I didn't get to over the hump and Trump, but wanted to give my friends a little bit of air time. I'm going to take a break. I'm going to go watch some Brewers. We'll be talking to you again soon, everybody. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it is always better when we stand together for results and data-driven public safety policy.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.